Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome. Thank you for tuning in to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, the extended edition. I appreciate your listener loyalty, especially on a Friday night when I'm sure you have lots to choose from to do. Well, I hope you like this evening's opening little tease music snippet from Be Optimistic and it's a song called Maria, which was inspired by the Sacred Feminine. And you heard them say, Maria is with you wherever you are. Well, if you're tuning in tonight on Friday instead of the usual Wednesday, you probably know that we're immersed in our Foremothers and Wayshowers series, which will go on till the end of February. The series has been inspired by many of you who have been keeping in touch with me over the last 20 months of the show, saying you want inspiration, guidance, connection, and to keep updated on what those folks you recognize as elders, foremothers, and wayshowers think is important right now. The latest guest we've booked for the series is Christina Biaggi, who will be interviewed in February. So keep tuning in here every Wednesday night or listen from the archives and hear what these trailblazers are up to at this point in their life's work. Tonight our guest is Joan Marler, just back from the NYU exhibition called The Lost World of Old Europe, the Danube Valley, 5000 to 3500 BC, which can be viewed there at NYU from November of this month through April 25th of next year. We'll be talking about that, as well as the work of Maria Gimbutas and other important topics on tonight's show. Then on the series, we have Barbara Walker up next on the show next Tuesday. Another scheduling change due to taking a week off for Thanksgiving. We'll actually have two shows in 1 week because following the next day at our regular time on Wednesday at 6 o'clock, we'll have with us Genevieve Vaughn, popular for her gift economy ideas and as the founder of the Sekhmet Temple outside Las Vegas. We'll take a break for Thanksgiving week, and we're back the first week of December with Patricia Monahan. So just a reminder, if you're new to Voices of the Sacred Feminine here on Blog Talk, or if you haven't listened in a while, we can take your caller questions. So if you like, dial in and ask toward the end of the interview at 718-766-4662. When I see your call on the switchboard, I'll identify you by your area code and welcome you to have a chance to ask our guest a question. And that number, once again, is 718-766-4662. Remember, if you can't listen live or don't want to be on the air, you can always email me some of your questions in advance. But keep tuning in each Wednesday at 6. Don't miss us. In fact, you can join Blog Talk as a listener and have reminders sent to your email box of our shows so you won't forget about our awesome lineup of guests each week. And please, if you like what you hear, become a fan of the show and indicate that by selecting Voices of the Sacred Feminine as a favorite on Blog Talk Radio. Well, it's time for my What's the Buzz segment when I share with you the bees buzzing around in my bonnet during the week. So when we talk about what's happening out there in the world related to goddess advocates or issues of women and girls and ideals of the sacred feminine. Today, most of what I'll share comes from one of my favorite new blogs called The Uncommon Scold on Newsvine.com. First up, with Veterans Day only a few days past, we salute women in the military because women are veterans too. Did you know that there are almost 2 million women veterans from the American Revolution to Panama, Bosnia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, and Iraq? Women have served in some way in every conflict. Not that they were legal in the early days. History tells us that 33,000 women served in World War I, and almost 500,000 took part in World War II. During the Korean era, 120,000 women were in uniform, and 7,000 were deployed in theater during Vietnam. During Desert Storm, 7% of the total U.S. forces deployed were women, over 40,000. So no matter how you feel about war, these women have sacrificed much for many of us, and we salute your service. Secondly, in another article about military women, the VA admits its failure to give women veterans proper care. In addition to combat-related PTSD, at least 20% of women veterans must deal with mental issues from being sexually assaulted in the military, and this is from VA officials. In a recent assessment of the treatment women get through their department, VA officials found few of their facilities offered women-only counseling. Most women who've experienced sexual assault wouldn't want to attend co-ed group therapy, said director of the health care of the VA, and most clinics didn't have full-time gynecologists either. And if I might make a peripheral comment along these lines of women in the military being sexually assaulted, at a recent ritual my group put on at the Goddess Temple of Orange County called To Honor and Heal Those Who Serve, one of the women who was in attendance stepped up and spoke about the sexual abuse from male soldiers that female soldiers all too often encounter. Sadly, she shared, many of their fellow male soldiers, those predisposed to this misogyny, actually referred to women in the military as mattresses. Yes, mattresses. It was hard to hear, but hear it we must. So let's shed the light of day on it so it might be addressed and the problem solved. And still on the topic of the military and veterans, because in my mind, goddess ideals are about the needs of the many, not the few, the most powerful or rich, I'd like to comment on homelessness on Veterans Day. About one-third of all adult homeless men are veterans, and an average night finds an estimated 131,000 of them from five decades bedding down on streets and in charity sanctuaries. About 3 in 100 are back from Iraq and Afghanistan. The problem of homelessness for Vietnam veterans is shamefully well known, but the men and women in this growing cohort took just 18 months to find rock bottom compared to the 5 years plus of the previous generation's veterans. General Shinkeski has promised to galvanize the Department of Veterans Affairs to lead a national drive to end veteran homelessness in the next 5 years. Is that anywhere near possible, he was asked, and his answer was, unless I put an ambitious target on the table, I don't know how we'll start. What I'd like to add to that is, you know, the Bush administration might be gone, but we're left to shovel out what they left behind. They were big on talking about supporting the troops, but short on actually really helping our veterans. In fact, the armed forces gave the Bush administration a failing grade when it came to actually how it provided for the troops. Now, Michelle Obama has pledged to make part of her mission as First Lady to help military families, so we'll see how that goes. And just two final quick stories which will make your hair stand on end, and these aren't very long. A group of past and present University of Sydney students set up a pro-rape page in the sports and recreation section of Facebook, describing themselves as anti-consent. The male students, mostly from the elite all-male St. Paul's College, initially ensured the Define statutory group had they wanted to make sure they had an open public profile and proudly displayed their membership on their personal Facebook page. And have you heard the rhetoric of the new propaganda machine, the propaganda machine of Wall Street? Yes, here are some quotes of a filthy rich Goldman Sachs representative who works on Wall Street who was bailed out by taxpayer money. They're actually saying Jesus embraced greed. Here's two of his quotes. The injunction of Jesus to love others as ourselves is an endorsement of self-interest. We have to tolerate the inequality as a way to achieving greater prosperity and opportunity for all. Well, these were things actually spouted in St. Paul's Cathedral in London. It's seems this idea of greed is love and taking is sharing is going to be the next spin we hear out there. Matt Taibbi reported on this. You might know him from Vanity Fair articles. He says, or asks, do they really believe this is true or hope we're just stupid enough to believe it's true? Just when you think you've heard it all. And if you're wondering why I consistently have this segment opening each show, well, it's because the programming has been so pervasive. We have to constantly be aware and educate. We have to inoculate ourselves against ignorance, intolerance, injustice, and those insidious isms. All right. Well, the bees are released from my bonnet for another week. And now to our guest, Joan Marler. Joan, welcome to the show, and thank you for your patience during the What's the Buzz segment.
Oh, thank you, Karen. And I'm so happy that you are bringing up these very, very important points, because there's so much of it in the environment that we can become, just take it as the background. You know,
yes, I think we become numb, you know, or we get so tired of hearing the negative, we just sort of turn off the news, and, you know, sometimes we miss, you know, some of these things that are actually going on out there, because some of it's awfully hard to hear.
That's right. Well, it's called psychic numbing.
Psychic numbing. I've never heard that, but that's a great, great phrase. Well, Joan, for some of our listeners who might be new to your work and Maria, let me just read your short bio, and then we're going to get into who Maria is and how you met her and all that good stuff. So this is Joan. Joan is a scholar, writer, and editor who worked closely with archaeologist Maria Gimbutas as her personal editor and biographer. She is the editor of The Civilization of the Goddess from 1991 by Maria Gimbutas, and From the Realm of the Ancestors, an anthology in honor of Maria Gimbutas from 1997. She's the founder and executive director of the Institute of Archaeomythology, and she's the editor of the online Journal of Archaeomythology. Thank you for your hard work, Joan.
Well, we're all doing what we can, aren't we? I think we get assignments from the universe.
Doesn't it feel like that? So, you know, you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and you just know there's something you're supposed to be doing, and, you know, you jump in with 2 feet.
Exactly.
Well, so, Joan, for folks, you know, maybe some of the younger listeners out there, tell us who Maria Gimbutas was and why she's so important to us today still.
Well, Maria Gimbutas was an archaeologist, born and raised in Lithuania, and she basically received a classical education there, first of all in linguistics, as well as in folklore and in ethnology, and also, of course, in archaeology. And she was interdisciplinary from the very beginning, and extremely motivated, because she came from a family of scholars, and people who had for generations devoted themselves to scholarship. And as a matter of fact, her parents and her parents' parents came out of the 19th century rise of the intelligentsia in Lithuania, and these were people who were farmers. These were not people who were elites. These were people who recognized that education was the key to cultural survival, and that their very lives and identity had to do with their culture and their connection to the earth and their connection to their inheritance, folkloric inheritance. And so she received that very, very strongly. Both of her parents were medical doctors as well as historians, and very much devoted to the continuity of Lithuanian culture under very extraordinary, difficult situations, First World War, Second World War, and so on. And they told her over and over again that it was very, very important that she give something to society to enrich the culture, that not only her own culture, but whatever, the world culture. And so it wasn't just for her that she was working. And all the kids got that. I mean, she had a brother, but all her cousins and her niece, the entire extended family, had that as a kind of credo. She was a refugee during the war. She married and had two children, and then came to this country as a refugee in 1949 and spent 13 years at Harvard University as a researcher and produced a number of very important books there. Then in 1963, she was given a position at UCLA, and she remained there as a professor of European archaeology until she left that position in 1989, and then she passed away in 1994. But throughout that time, there were a series of major contributions that she made with her work. So her work, even though people can know her from different stages, is really a very, very rich composite of many different layers of contribution. So we can kind of get into those different parts during the course of this discussion.
Okay. How did you actually meet her and begin working with her?
I met her during the 1980s. I had a radio program on KPFA, which is the kind of the mother station of the public stations of the world, and it was an amazing place, and still is, to work. And I gained confidence there. I found my voice there, and I just felt like, well, anybody that I want to talk with, who I think is important, will talk with me, of course. You know, I just had that kind of, I developed that kind of enthusiasm and confidence. And Joseph Campbell was a very important teacher to me, and I considered him a mentor. And at a certain point, he began to speak about this very amazing Lithuanian-American archaeologist, Maria Gimbutas, and show some of the pictures from her work. And he said that if he had had her work earlier, he would have written some of his work very differently. And as a mythologist, I mean, I know that he'd affected me very, very much. And if he said that, I knew I had to meet her. And I had actually a primal experience when he began speaking about her. I felt that I was just being enlivened and kind of stroked all the way up the chakras. I was just ringing with this sense that, aha, this is life-shattering. This is very important. I absolutely have to find her. So I did find her, and I interviewed her for radio, and we had a very good connection from the beginning, and she found out that I had also done editing, and she asked me to do some editing for her. She sort of checked me out. And eventually she asked me to work with her on The Civilization of the Goddess, which then was eventually published in 1991. And during the time of working with her, it was astonishing. It just completely brought my life into a dynamic focus, which I was moving toward, but she was the catalyst in a profound way. And she's been catalytic to many people who recognize the profundity of her scholarship and her perception.
Well, I know you've already mentioned Joseph Campbell, but I remember one of his quotes when I was researching my own book and writing a little bit about him and her, and he called her work a Rosetta Stone, you know,
yes,
unlocking the keys to the past for us. You know, I've always felt that she could almost hear those artifacts speaking to her, you know, that intuitive divine connection that maybe some archaeologists don't let themselves go there.
Well, she had an amazing childhood in which she grew up in Lithuania, which was one of the very, very last countries of Europe to be Christianized, so that the deepest pagan layer was still alive. It had been shredded to a certain extent, but even, you know, during the early decades of the 20th century, there were many elements that were still alive. I mean, she said she saw the village people kissing the earth in the morning and evening, and she said that there were certain things, like you weren't supposed to spit on the earth or hit the earth in the spring because the earth is pregnant. There was a sense that the earth is this living body that is necessary to be respected. And I remember going there in 1993 with her on her last trip to Lithuania. She died the following year. And we visited with an old couple who had lived all, you know, through the Second World War and, you know, way before. They grew up also with an ancient tradition of the folk culture. And they said how painful it was to have the Soviets come in and destroy the forest, just loot the forest, because for them it was sacred. And it was that sense of the earth as sacred. And they began to weep, and she began to weep, and then I began to weep. You know, it was just this moment of acknowledging that there's something so deep and profound of people living in the natural world with this resonance to it, that it is alive and it's sacred, and that is in the folklore. So she experienced that these folkloric elements were part of a living fabric of culture. So when she began working with the signs and symbols, the very, very rich symbolism of the earliest farmers, the Neolithic societies of Europe, she recognized many of the motifs. Not only that, she recognized that they weren't just individual signs or individual symbols, but they had come from a living context. And she says that these symbols, the reference to them is living nature. The reference to them has to do with people's experience of living in connection with nature, so that nature is not a background, but it's like all our relations. You know, it's this sense that we are one with this earth. And it was that understanding that informed her perception of the material and her work with the material and her response to the material. So there was something very, I think, profound about her sensitivity and the depth to which she interpreted.
Makes perfect sense. Thank you for sharing that story. Well, if you had to say, I mean, I know her life was full of incredible achievements and discoveries and theories, and but what were her main scholarly achievements, and why do you think those, why do you choose those? Why are they the most important for us?
Right. Well, her very first book, which was published, which was actually the publication of her PhD thesis, and she got her PhD at Tübingen University right after the war was over. And that was about basically the ancient motifs in Lithuania, from an interdisciplinary perspective, of course. When she came to the United States and she was working at Harvard, one of the books that she published was the Prehistory of Eastern Europe. And since she had a vast knowledge of the Eastern European languages as well as Western European languages, and that she began to go to Eastern Europe through the Iron Curtain to travel and to be an exchange scholar, she was able to be in connection with the archaeologists there and to read the material, not only the material that was coming into the Peabody Museum, which had a vast collection of everything that the university could get, but also to be in touch with the scholars that were there. So she crossed the political and linguistic borders to make a concentration of everything that was written from the beginning of archaeology up to 1955 about the Eurasian, the area of Northern Europe, Northeastern Europe, that was her focus at that time. And that book really became almost like a Bible for scholars who could not otherwise have access to this material.
And what was the title again?
It was The Prehistory of Eastern Europe.
Okay.
That there's a longer title, of and it included the Mesolithic, Paleolithic, Mesolithic, and I'm sorry, I don't have it right in front of me.
That's okay. That's okay. I'm sorry.
I'll probably read the subtitle.
You can tell us later.
Yeah. But that had an effect. And then she wrote, of course, a book about the Balts and the Slavs. And then her big book on Bronze Age cultures in Eastern and Central Europe was published in 1965, which really established her as a world-class scholar on the Indo-European Bronze Age. Now the Bronze Age is typified by warriors and mounds with weapons. And it was basically the archaeology from Bronze Age societies is filled with evidence of war. At a certain point after that, she just said, I'm finished with this. She was really sick of all this war. And she realized that there was something going on in the earlier societies that was extremely different. And these early societies in Europe were the first farmers. And they're dated from mostly in the Balkan Peninsula from around, you know, the mid-7th millennium BC, maybe 67, 6500 BC, and then all the way through to around 3500 BC in all of Eastern Europe. Well, that was it. She decided she had to know what that was, and that really was an enormous direction that brought her study of figurines and brought her study of social structure and brought out her study of all those contrasts between these societies that were embedded in the spirituality of the earth for their sustainability. The other part, I mean, that's the part that probably interests most of the listeners to this program, but I should also say that there was another and very, very important focus of her work, which had to do with why there was a change from these earlier stable, mature societies that produced this enormous production of female imagery from the ritual context to the warrior cults, the Bronze Age societies. What happened to change it? And so that her theory about what happened to change it is another huge contribution.
Well, her theories were some of the, interpretations were probably some of her most significant contributions about the egalitarian societies and the Kurgans and all of that, right?
Yes, right. And the thing is that they're still resonating. They're still having their influence. And right now there's a pretty big backlash that's going on, at least in Western Europe, around her work. But, and that used to really, that, you know, I had a lot of grief around that. But then I decided at a certain point that it would be very, very important to study what I call the literature of the controversy. Because she was philosophical about it. It had already started before she passed away. And her response was, of course, it's perfectly understandable. I mean, that there would be this kind of convulsion in her own field.
Well, Joan, I think we might be getting just a tad bit ahead of ourselves because some of our listeners might not know that her work was a bit controversial. So maybe talk about that a little bit so that listeners new to this material understand maybe why her work wasn't always, you know, received 100% and that, you know, there wasn't always consensus about, you know, her theories and interpretations.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we have to step back just a little bit more than that and to come at it from a place of speaking more about what that work of the early societies, what that work was about.
Okay.
And then what were the controversial elements there. So her focus on the earlier farmers, those societies, basically are the people who developed farming first in Europe. The farming technology that came from the Near East through Anatolia and then into what is now Greece and then spread up into the Balkans and then out from there. And as I said earlier, it's from the, let's say, mid-7th millennium BC to the mid-4th millennium BC, which is around, let's say, 6500 to 3500 if you want to round things up, BC. And the societies that developed were primarily stable, non-warlike, and many of the sites were lived in for many, many hundreds of years. And it really hit me a few years ago, oh my goodness, these Neolithic societies of early farmers developed sustainable societies that lasted hundreds and hundreds of years, up to 1,000 years or more.
Better than we're doing.
Just think about that. We are so far from being sustainable.
Right.
And these are the first people, and anybody out there who's listening who's ever farmed, no, it's not such an easy thing to do. It's very, I mean, you are at the mercy of the elements and everything that wants to eat what you're growing. And you have to be very resonant. You have to be very aware. You have to be, you know, you have to interact. And you can't do what some of these armchair archaeologists say, you know, of man's domination over nature. You know, it's like you're never going to get there that way. I mean, Monsanto might be trying to do it, but that's it's a failure. watering the earth. So they were sustainable by being in harmony. And at the center of that sustainability was a tremendous ritual life. And at the center of that ritual life was the female imagery. And then, about the female imagery, Maria had no problem referring to the female images in all their different forms as goddesses. And that, I think, was a big, you know, explosion, because what do we have in the Hebraic Christian tradition but this idea that thou shalt have no other gods before me, you know, the primary male deity, and you start saying that there's a goddess there and that she's the one, that's blasphemous.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you are no longer Christian, you know, even if there is still that sense that it's somehow dangerous, or it can be absolutely the most wonderful thing you've ever heard in your whole life. You know,
right.
I think that there was a great celebration, you know, when people found her work. And still today, it's like, oh my gosh, these are images that are considered sacred that are like me.
Mm-hmm.
Not like me, but you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the face of woman.
That's right. So that in itself was something that was really hard for a lot of people who are more traditionally oriented to take.
Did Maria have to listen to some of the stuff we hear today about these ancient artifacts or just ancient Barbie dolls or ancient pornography? Was that out there then when
was
teaching?
And she commented on that. I mean, she just thought that was the most absurd thing she'd ever heard. Because what she saw was that these images were metaphoric of deeply spiritual concepts. And if you don't have a sense of what metaphor is, if you don't have a sense of what symbolism is about or what myth is about, and you think it's something trivial or something that's a lie, myth is a lie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you don't get it. You know,
mm-hmm.
if you're only materially oriented. But she defined goddess in her terms. She said, the goddess is all life in nature. It's like this, if you look at the Earth from outer space, the pictures of Earth from outer space, that planet that is giving, all life is coming forth in this myriad of appearance of all forms of life, and then it's dying, and then it's returning, and this great kind of teeming movement of arising and returning and arising and returning out of itself. That was her concept, and that there were many, 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 many different aspects to this mystery in female form, and that people would conceive of sacred source in terms of the female. And it was only later, and Joseph Campbell, the mythologist Joseph Campbell, refers to it as the great reversal, when that whole thing turned completely around and the creator was spoken about then, or conceived in male form, creating life out of something that was not of his substance. So there's a separation, that deity is out there, male deity is out there, not of this place, giving birth to life from, you know, from himself, no. So that there's a schism there. And we've been suffering with this schism for a very long time. So she recognized the multiplicity of what she called goddesses, these female images, and that they refer to a very, very rich and deeply resonant conception within these early societies of kind of the source of life taking many, many forms. And that included the death aspect and the regeneration aspect, the entire cycle of life, which means you come into being, you mature, and then you go out of being, you decay, and then there's a metamorphosis to come back again. And every stage of that has an expression.
Well, now in Çatalhöyük in Turkey, or Anatolia as it used to be called, she worked there with James Mellert, and she was able to see her theories there in this ancient community, correct?
Well, actually, I mean, she knew Jimmy Mellert, but she'd never worked at Çatalhöyük.
Okay.
But she was very much supportive of his concept of the female images as goddesses, because basically he had an orientation that was very similar to hers in understanding them as metaphors, understanding that this had to do with people's deeply spiritual concepts, and there was a reason that they were creating them and that they were part of their ritual life. So, yeah, I mean, they were definitely aligned with each other and mutually supporting.
Well, now, starting to move into, you know, why her theories weren't always, you know, there wasn't always consensus out there about her theories. I know using Çatalhöyük as an example, Ian Hodder out there, the primary archaeologist at the site, hasn't there sort of been this ongoing back and forth about how he's interpreting the pieces he finds out there, sort of the Maria Gimbutas idea versus the Ian Hodder idea? I don't know if that's the best way to describe it, but you can explain better.
Well, there's a concerted effort to overturn Maria's ideas as well as Mellert. Of course, since James Mellert found Çatalhöyük, and he interpreted, he was the first one to interpret the material culture because he was the first one to dig there. They are very much into revising his theory. And there's some, kind of, in my view, very kind of strange and almost strangely humorous, if you want to keep a sense of humor, about some of the ways that they're doing it. So, anyway, not to get into a lot of... Well, okay, I'll tell you one story. I was there 1 year and with the group organized by Lydia Rule, who's done a wonderful, you know, group to Çatalhöyük and making connections with the archaeologists and really wanting to make bridges so that there's not such a schism between the goddess scholars and the archaeologists that are there. And so she organized with Ian Hodder, who is very open to this, in a series of meetings in which there would be presentations and then there would be discussions. And one of the presentations the first year that we did this was from a young lady who had been working with the figurines. And what she said was that they'd found that there were basically only 2% of the images were female, that were clearly identified as female. And most of them are not identified, and then... But a lot of them, actually more, are male. I said, well, how did you come to that? And she said, well, you know, we added up all of the pieces that looked like they were formed by human hands, and even if they were fragments. And then we counted all the ones that were clearly female. And then we, you know, divided that number, and we found out that there were only 2%. I said, are you're using fragments and animals as well? Oh, yeah, she said.
Well, that diluted the numbers.
Of course. You know, and I... Anyway, so
they're crazy.
Kind of stepping back a little bit from that, but there's a concerted attempt to dilute the idea that the female images were so prominent. But if you go to the Ankara Museum and you walk through, look at the case of artifacts of the from the Mellert exhibit, It's all female. I mean, there are a couple of pieces that could be said, well, maybe that's a male. But, I mean, but it's mostly female. It's almost entirely female.
Well, what do you think is at the root of the problem? Does it fall along gender lines? Is it professional jealousy? Do they just not like how she arrived at her conclusions? You know, what's really at the heart of the controversy?
I think it's something that's very deep in the Western psyche, frankly, that we've been so imbued with the idea that, you know, that the male is at the top and that it is a very difficult thing to recognize that the female could be very important at the center. But I think, you know, there are a lot of levels to it. And this program is not long enough to really take all those arguments apart
and
get down to it. But I think that as time goes on, there's going to be more and more understanding about and openness to the idea that the female element could be honored at the center of culture, and that that does not push down men, that what we had here are balanced societies. In fact, Ian Hodder himself has come to that. I think it's really quite wonderful that he is. He could not find, for instance, any evidence of imbalance between men and women at Chattahoochee.
But yet he saw a difference in the deity, though. Deity had to be male.
Well, what he did was, interestingly, he wrote a major article for Scientific American, I think it was 98, or I'm sorry, I can't bring up the exact year, but he basically said, aha, and this proves Maria Gimbutas wrong. And, of course, a number of us wrote in and said, well, no, that actually proves her right, because what she was saying was that these were balanced societies. And she refused to use the word matriarchy because she recognized that the most typical use of the, at that time particularly, of the word matriarchy was that it refers to women ruling in the same way that men rule in patriarchy. Of course, as an aside, I have to say that there's quite a lot of work being done right now to redeem that word matriarchy and to see that it's can also mean balanced societies in which women were honored. But she didn't use it because she precisely did not want to give the impression that women were ruling in a punitive way, similar to patriarchal rule. But that's exactly the way he interpreted her, even though she didn't say that. So I had the opportunity to interview him, and I actually have one of the articles, one of the issues of the Journal of Archaeomythology that's on the Institute of Archaeomythology website now, and it's devoted to Chattahoochee, in which I asked him about that. And I said, you know, you say that she said Chattahoochee was a matriarchy, but she specifically said that it was not. And he admitted that he had not read her work since he was an undergraduate. He'd not read her work since he was an undergraduate, which meant he hadn't read anything since Gods and Goddesses of Old Europe, 74.
And that was how many years later?
This was just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, so decades.
And then he admitted that, well, maybe he was influenced by, you know, what other people are saying, and that's exactly the point, that people start saying things, and then it's picked up, and it's passed from, you know, it's published in an article or something, and then it becomes real, and then it's said again and again and again, and it takes on a kind of currency as though that is actually what it is, rather than going to her work to read what she said, and there's a lot of that going on. But now I do want to say that there are archaeologists who are recognizing the value of what Maria Gimbutas has contributed in all the different spheres that she's worked in. So not to give the idea that she's just over on one side all by herself, because certainly the first, whole part of her life, she was extremely recognized as a world-class scholar and honored and the top honors. But of course, it was when she started using the word goddess and doing interpreting that things started changing for many people. But there are still some amazing archaeologists who are still understanding that there's a deep value in what she has contributed. And I would like to mention one of them. And his name is David Anthony, and he happens to be the curator of this exhibit in New York through the Institute for the Study of the Ancient World that I just came from. that you mentioned in the introduction. And the he's the, as I said, the guest curator of this exhibition, The Lost World of Old Europe. And I bought several copies of the catalog and was very pleased to read some of the things that he was saying about Maria, because it was his choice to use her terminology. Now, when this when the announcement for this exhibition went out, and people who have been very connected with Maria picked it up, of course they recognized her terminology, Old Europe, because that is what she called the cultures of the earliest farmers. And she said it was a true civilization. It was before the Bronze Age. It was non-Indo-European. It was balanced. You know, women were honored, and all of this incredibly rich cultural material came forth from it that spoke of that. So Old Europe is hers. And so the question came up, all right, they're using her terminology for this exhibit, but where is her name? Plus, there are a couple of scholars who are in the catalog who are going to be speaking later on in the year, who have distinguished themselves as being critics of Maria. So that, and other big flags came up.
So that's why you thought it was important enough to fly from California to New York to check this out?
Well, that I certainly, I had to know, yes. But I had also received two different invitations. One was to the opening. It was an invitation-only event. And then the next day, which was just a couple days ago, was the curatorial dialogue between David Anthony and Dr. Popovich from the main archaeological museum in Bucharest. And I really wanted to be there for that too. And what I found was, in talking with David Anthony too, because I'd never had the opportunity to speak with him, although I had followed his work over the years, he said specifically that he wanted to use her work to recognize her, and because her concept of Old Europe and what is contained within that terminology for him was the most viable way of expressing what that civilization was. And I just thought, you know, right on. Thank you very much. That is really great. And he had a hand in, since he was the guest curator for the show, making sure that the literature that was on the walls and these elegantly presented wall hangings were very delicately worded so that they didn't have the sting that's in a couple of the articles in this anthology. He really wanted it to be respectful, and he did a beautiful job of that, in my view.
That's good news.
He actually told me a story, I told him that I'm returning to work on her biography after kind of a hiatus. And so he told me a couple of stories that really illustrated his connection with her. He said he was at a conference in Austin, Texas, a couple of decades ago, and she was there. And he was a graduate student, and, you know, graduate students can be kind of cocky and want to distinguish themselves from their elders and so on. And they were on a panel, and she was sitting right next to him, and he stood up, and he made a very critical comment of her Pergen hypothesis. I think he was critical of her concept of what he defined as the Kurgans, who were defined them as Indo-European speakers, Proto-Indo-European speakers, and they were patriarchalist, they were warlike, and so on, and they came into Europe and basically initiated the end of Old Europe. Well, after he made his statement of being critical of her work, he thought that, well, that's it, she's going to hate him, and you know, he's going to be, you know, kind of at war with her, and that's just the way that is. Later on, she came up to him, and she gave him a kiss on the cheek, and she said, "I'm very glad to know that there's someone who will be continuing this work." And he said he was stunned, and he thought about that for a very long time. What did she do? What happened just then? Well, you know what she did. She blessed him. She blessed him because she saw that he was, had an inquiring mind and that he had the attributes necessary to carry on this work about the Indo-European, the early Indo-European societies, the development of the Proto-Indo-Europeans, which is absolutely necessary. You know, she needed a younger scholar to come forth.
Mm-hmm.
He actually did that. He actually focused his life on this work. And it was from that kiss. It was from that, you know, it was just like the magic wand going ding.
Wow, that's an awesome story.
Yeah, he also said earlier that he had been reading, read and reread and reread and reread her book from 1956 that was published while she was at Harvard, The Prehistory of Eastern Europe. And he said it was from that book that he gained the courage to excavate in Russia of the steppe culture. So, you know, that's what it is. It's not this impulse to make enemy. It's not the impulse to polarize. But it's that tremendous genius that she had to look deeply into people. And there's some people who are listening to this tonight who've had that experience with Maria. She looked into you and she saw the potential. And then she would do something to enliven it, to catalyze it. And I'm not the only one who has been profoundly influenced by her. You mentioned Christina Biaggi, who's going to be on your show.
Mm-hmm.
Christina has been profoundly influenced by Maria. Vicki Noble is another. Many other people. You know, I could just name a whole list of really great scholars. Many women, but as in this case with David Anthony, male scholars as well. So, you know, those of us, there are many of us who are carrying on the work in many, many different ways, and we were seeded with a perception. And it doesn't mean we agree with everything. But she always said, think for yourself, don't be a sheep. You know, if you have the inclination to do something, do it. Work your whole life at it. Take risks. You know, dare to step out on the edge and go beyond.
Oh, she certainly did.
Yeah. So she encourages all of us to do that.
What an example. Well, going back to the NYU exhibit, so I think I'd probably be remiss if I don't ask, since they have some of her critics coming up in the future giving presentations, are they going to have the opportunity for folks, you know, some scholars that might present her view of all of this, you know, also given presentations?
I don't have the list in front of me of the presenters. And I know that it's they're just a limited number of people who are presenting. And when I was there, I overheard at least one person asking to be added to the list. I also made a suggestion of someone who could be added to the list. But, you know, it's a process, and I don't know how much flexibility there is there.
I see.
And I also haven't analyzed to see beyond, you know, two of the presenters who those other people are in terms of their position.
So you would say then, I guess, just as sort of just to sum this all up, she hasn't been disappeared or dismissed in this event?
Oh, certainly not by David Anthony. I think that there are some real challenges to her interpretation by some of the presenters and also by a couple of the articles that are in the catalog. But as Maria would say, it's perfectly understandable. I mean, look, what she did was basically rewrite the charter text of European civilization. She turned everything around. She basically said in the very beginning it wasn't the male god. In the very beginning it wasn't fighting and warfare and warriors. But the earliest societies were people who were connected to the earth with a profound earth-based spirituality, and they were sustainable. They, at the center of that sustainability was their ritual life, and at the center of that, this is my extrapolation and my wording, not her wording, but it's the same spirit, And at the center of that ritual life was the female imagery. And there was male imagery too, but primarily the female was definitely the strongest and most prevalent. And that said something about their concept of sacred source and their concept of how they perceived these great cycles of life. And that they groomed for balance. They didn't try to bludgeon each other down. It wasn't that at all. So
it was
cooperation and partnership, as Rion Eisler would say, it's a partnership society rather than the dominated society. That's not the origin story that we've been given.
Right, absolutely.
So of course, she just said, there's gonna be a reaction to this. But time will tell. And she gave herself, she said, probably in about 35 years. People will be able to see more. There are big ripples.
I was just commenting on that. Envisioning the day when we don't even bat an eye at the idea that goddess was primary. as she predicted, possibly.
Yes, but that concept of the female as sacred source. At the center of balanced societies, and this does not mean that the males were somehow reduced, or that the males were somehow suffering under the system. I think there are beautiful ethnographic examples of that principle in action, and Peggy Reeves Sande, who is a fabulous anthropologist from University of Pennsylvania, has been doing for decades work with a culture group in West Sumatra called the Manangabao, who call themselves matriarchal. And she's made many parallels between the Manangabao and the evidence of what remains in the archaeological record of old European societies and the work of Maria Gimbutas. And here it is that everyone is working together for the balance, for the health, the sustainability of the society.
Rather than being programmed like we are, that there has to be winners and losers.
Exactly. So, it behooves us to take a look at other societies in the world in which this kind of mentality is operative. And when it hit me a few years ago that these societies in old Europe were sustainable, because that's a big, word now. It's a big concept now, because we're so unsustainable. So I thought, what is needed for sustainability? What is the minimum? What are those minimum elements needed for sustainability? And were they in old Europe? Well, one of the things is that if you're going to have a sustainable society, the most damaging activity for sustainability is warfare. And that every human being that's ever has been born on this planet has the full capacity of being the most loving and the most horrendous. We all have that in us, but it's a matter of how we're enculturated. It's a matter of what choices are made to amplify one into the spectrum or another. And these societies, I'm quite sure, could not have been balanced without grooming for peacefulness, without having ways to resolve conflict, rather than just bludgeoning each other down. So that's one thing. There's so much that can be said about what is it that would make it possible for Vinci culture to last more than 1,000 years, or Cefalo culture, or Demeny culture, or Caronival, or any of the old European culture groups, to develop such a stable, mature fabric of culture that they could produce such incredible expressions of their spirituality. And not only that, but one of the basic motifs of the pottery, as well as on the bodies of figurines, as well as on painted on the house walls and so on, was this great flowing, circular, meandering forms that were beautifully in balance and dynamic. And what could be an expression of a consciousness in balance in a dynamic balance with the flow of the whole signs like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's incredible. Mm-hmm. You can just read it kinesthetically. Read all of these designs kinesthetically. Even the geometric ones are in perfect balance, and they're exquisite. And it's a consciousness, this expression of consciousness.
Well, Joan, we probably have about 15 minutes left, and a few more things I wanted to get to. Most of us who know Maria know she passed away in 94, and since she left us, you know, there have been other archaeological discoveries that she didn't get to see. Have her interpretations remained relevant, you know, based on some of these new things that have come down the pike?
Yes, I actually think it's a very exciting time, and I'm not worried now about resistance that some scholars might have to her ideas. I think that's something that will fade, because what I see happening, and I'm doing my very, very best to track the latest developments, by developing a whole huge library here as part of the Institute of Archaeomythology, and reading as much as I can, and traveling to Eastern Europe, and being in dialogue with archaeologists. What I'm seeing is that whether or not she is mentioned, it almost, you know, I mean, it's beside the point in terms of what's coming forth. There is a mosaic of discoveries coming forth that whether or not they have her name associated with them or not, and many times now they do not, a picture is arising that, in my view, is absolutely in harmony with the entire gestalt of what she was saying and what she was writing about and what she was doing. I mean, some of the details can change. Some of the refinement of dates can change. Some of the blanks that he couldn't fill in are being filled in, but I think there's a real acknowledgement that will come into the future to say, "Wow, she understood this." You know, this is like, I mean, the transformation of culture, the nature of the old European societies, all of it. I think we're going to see a renaissance sometime in the future, of more and more people recognizing the real genius of what she had to offer. So
that would, it would be a long time coming.
Yes.
Well, tell us a little bit about the Institute of Archaeomythology and what it is, you know, that you're working on right now.
Well, the Institute of Archaeomythology, I formed it with some colleagues in order to continue the work, basically. And of course, Maria Gimbutas coined the term archaeomythology as an interdisciplinary way of studying, researching the beliefs, the rituals, the symbolism of earliest societies. Of course, it can be applied to any society in any part, in any time period, but it's very useful and necessary for the very earliest societies. And one of the themes that she was extremely interested in is in Chapter 8 of Civilization of the Goddess is what she called the Old European Script or the Sacred Script. And so at one point I thought, well, gee, I wonder what the archaeologists in Eastern Europe who are digging up the materials, the figurines and the pots and various ritual artifacts, the portable altars and all of these things that are inscribed with signs. What do they think this stuff is? And so the first event around this subject we did in 2004, and that was in Serbia in collaboration with the Serbian Academy of Sciences and Arts, and that was at their facility in Novi Sad. And we brought together archaeologists from the entire region, from Serbia and Bulgaria and Ukraine and Greece and also in Western Europe, to say, okay, what do you think this is? How are you thinking about this, as well as linguists and art historians and semiologists? And it was extremely interesting to just kind of take a litmus test of people's level of thinking about it. And what we found out was that there is a way of looking at the earliest stage of writing that they weren't really taking into consideration because the science of the history of writing was not part of their training. But what the science of the history of writing says is the very first stage of writing is signs and symbols representing ideas that are separate from the spoken language, and that there are certain criteria that have to be met for that early stage to represent writing. And the signs and symbols of Europe, of old Europe, absolutely meet that requirement. So we started talking about this as script. These signs and symbols used systematically throughout Southeast Europe as a form of expression of essential ideas. I mean, they had to be able to express essential ideas in order to be as successful as they were. But these ideas were expressed within the ritual realm, by the way, not for economic purposes. So the second event we had was last year, and it was in Romania in collaboration with the Brugenthal Museum. We had a huge exhibition and symposium, and that the proceedings have been published. The Institute of Archaeomythology became a publisher for that. And this year we collaborated with the National History Museum of Transylvania for another exhibition and symposium. And I'm working on that catalog. I mean, the catalog was published. I helped to edit that, but we're working on the proceedings right now, too. So it's a series of meeting with scholars, having events, publishing the results, and looking at the richness and the brilliance of those early societies in terms of their ability to transmit ideas within the ritual realm. So basically what we're working on right now.
And will the findings be shared there on your Institute of Archaeomythology site?
Yes, right now we just have some kind of rudimentary information. I really have to update the site, and I've only started to do that. So whoever looks at the site, please know that it's in process. The address of the site is archaeomythology.org, and it's spelled archaeomythology.org.
And did you want to mention something about the Journal of Archaeomythology?
Yes, absolutely. So the journal can be accessed online, and we encourage people to become members of this society so we can have a few little resources to work with, because all this publication and events do take resources. But if there's anybody out there who absolutely cannot afford the $25 student or unemployed rate or the $50 regular rate, just send me an email, and I can give you a gift subscription. When you have your username and password, then you have access to all of the issues of the journal.
Okay. Well, Joan, obviously Maria's theories and interpretations offer answers and directions for our today's problems of sustainability. But aside from that, are there any other important ideas you'd like to leave listeners with that might be related to our discussion tonight?
Well, I'm thinking of some of the favorite images that Maria had. You spoke often of the bird goddess. There are so many images of a female body with a bird mask. And of course, anytime you have a mask, you're in that ritual realm. You're in between worlds there. And when you see that an image of a female body, a woman's body, a human woman's body with the mask of an animal, regardless of what that animal is, whether it's bird or bear or other, it's like what the Native Americans here say, all my relations. Or in folkloric terms, in the beginning when humans and animals spoke the same language, that there's a shared consciousness that these are the animal people, and that we share this living world with all of life, and we can take on those attributes, and we can be that. There's not that separation. And this flow of identity, this flow of consciousness, this flow of perception was very well expressed there. And Maria really understood it, and she celebrated it. She got so much joy out of that, and it was palpable, really. I just want to leave with that idea, of really that we're part of this all together.
That's a good note to end on. Thank you. Well, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so very much. I know you must be exhausted from your trip. Thank you for doing the show tonight, Joan.
Well, thank you for asking me. It's been a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to speak about Maria. She was an extraordinary woman. It was an honor to know her. And she's definitely one that gives lifelong assignments, and there are many people out there who know what I'm talking about. I'm sitting up late at night, like, Maria, I'm still working. You know, I know that it takes another lifetime to accomplish this, but we're doing what we can. So,
well, thank you so very much for everything you're doing in her name and your own work too. Anything I can do, it's my pleasure to to give scholars like you a platform to share this work with our listeners.
Well, thank you, Karen. It's a very important what you're doing as well. And I would just like to give my email address if anybody would like to contact me.
Oh, absolutely. Go right ahead, please.
It is jmarler@archaeomythology.org, and that's spelled archaeomythology.org.
And I'm always happy to put our listeners in touch with our guests, too, if that's easier. So please feel free to ask, and I will certainly forward your comments along. Well, Joan, thank you very much. Please enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday coming up soon, and the best of luck on all this work that you have on your plate.
Thank you. The best of luck to you and to all the listeners, and we always have to be aware of what we have to be grateful for, and there's so much to be grateful for.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, good night. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just might save the world. Well, we're going to take a very short music break now. I'm going to let you listen to Breath of Passion by Zingaya. And please stay tuned with us, because there's some important things I'd like to tell you on the other side of this this music. This is Karen Tate, and I wanted to mention that I am the LA Women's and Goddess Spirituality Examiner. I'd invite you to check out my articles. You can find a link to those articles from the homepage of my website at karentate.com. Recently, we talked about her church in San Francisco, a Lutheran feminist church, and they just had their feminist conference last week, and we spoke about that, as well as the Queen of Your Realm convocation with Ava Park at the Goddess Temple of Orange County. The Queen of Your Realm convocation is actually a series of events. The first one was November 7th, but the next one is in February, then April, May, and September. You can experience the series as a single event or sign up for the whole series, which you can get a discount for. The focus of the Queen of Your Realm series is about ruling your life in peace, power, and prosperity to save yourself, your family, and, oh yes, the world. So for more information about that, please go to this email address. It's info@goddesstempleoforangecounty.com. Each event is $65, or as I said, you can get a discount for the series. One of the messages that came out of the series, which I thought was so very important, is women embracing their inner queen, and instead of being competitors with one another, that we actually treat each other as colleagues. Important message. If you've been meaning to tune in to my other radio show on CBS, Earth Sacred Places, don't delay. CBS is no longer providing airtime free, so I opted not to keep Earth Sacred Places on the air because of the cost involved. So don't miss the wonderful guests who are in the archives talking about sacred places of goddess around the world. We have shows on India, Nepal, Britain, France, on sacred display objects, and Sheila Nagigs, and just a wide variety of wonderful shows about all things goddess on Mother Earth. There's probably over a dozen shows there for an undetermined amount of time. So if you don't want to miss those before they disappear, go to psychiconair.com, look up my name as the host in the archives, and until they pull those, you can still listen. Also, Cakes for the Queen of Heaven series is coming up at the Goddess Temple in Orange County if you're in Southern California. That series is going to start in January and run through July. There's going to be a class every other week, $25 a class. The first series has 5 sessions and the second has 6, and yours truly has been asked to teach that. So I'm actually looking forward to teaching that feminist theology class series. This Sunday, I'll be giving a talk on November 15th at the Sophia Temple, otherwise called Olindar, at the home of Carla and Leigh McCloskey, and it's on the topic of sacred feminine for a sustainable future. Also, I wanted you to look for articles coming up on my Examiner column. We're going to be talking about new trends that include goddess worship at the Parliament of World Religions, as well as how the Cherry Hill Seminary faculty and staff fared when they presented last week at the American Academy of Religion. Well, if you like what you've been hearing on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, please tell your friends to tune in. Please add us as one of your Blog Talk favorites. Even consider signing up as a listener and have reminders of our upcoming shows sent directly to your email box. And as I close the show tonight, let's see, what am I going to leave you with? Let's turn to the Dragon Ritual drummers again, and I do thank the artists who have offered their music for your listener enjoyment. We've had Jenna Green and Flash Silvermoon and Laura Kane and Be Optimistic, and what I'm going to close the show with tonight is a song. Music, actually, it's not a song, drumming music by Dragon Ritual Drummers, and it's called Desert Horse. So please enjoy, and I'll see you on Monday and Tuesday of next week with Barbara Walker and then Genevieve Vaughn. Good night, listeners.